We might run out of tape, but I have others. Okay. Dr. Van Pelt, you're the only certified pathologist in the state, as far as I know. What does a pathologist do first, and how is that work different than a normal vet or a regular vet?
Well, basically, I perform the autopsies on dogs, either dying of natural causes or other reasons. We do a gross autopsy where we determine the basic cause of death, and then usually I collect various representative tissue specimens for examination under the light microscope, or maybe submission to a lab for bacteriologic cultures or viral studies. Essentially, we try to determine the cause of death, or in the case of a biopsy for a tumor or something like that, fundamentally whether it's benign or malignant.
Okay. You mentioned once while I was here that you feel that you're in a branch of sports medicine, and just judging by, you know, the amount of dog mushers and dogs that go through this place, I'm sure that's true. Could you expound on that idea a bit, you know, what you think about sports medicine and why you think you're in a branch of it?
Yeah, that's correct. We are in a branch of sports medicine, or I should say I am, in that fundamentally we're, you know, we have injured dogs come in, we have ill dogs come in, and I feel I'm in no different position than I would be if I were, say, a team physician or a physician with an Olympic team. And the East Germans and the Russians have advanced sports medicine so greatly to their advantage that I feel that, well, the U.S. is lagged behind it, and I feel that working with dogs or trying to overcome some of the problems in the racing dog, whether it be a sprint dog or a distance dog, is fundamental to the dog's health and its performance and well-being.
Okay, you were mentioning one thing like 10 years ago, for instance, a dog might, maybe even 5 years ago, a dog would get, maybe longer than 10, but a dog would, like, for instance, get a fracture in a foot, and, you know, I don't want to get down on the old-timers, but it would be more or less, well, that's the end of the dog, you know, you couldn't use the dog again, whereas now that isn't necessarily true.
That's correct. You know, 10 years ago, and particularly, I hate to say it, in some of the old-time mushers, they were more prone if a dog, say, had a minor fracture in the foot or a strain or tear in a ligament or tendon, there's a tendency to put the dog to sleep, where now we can go in on fractures, even major fractures, correct and repair the fracture, correct and repair tendons and ligaments, and we can usually have that dog back on the next racing season. If we catch a minor injury early enough, even a minor fracture, we many times can get that dog back in racing form and within the same season very easily. This wasn't done much 5 or 10 years ago, and certainly not 15 or 20. It was unheard of then. And frankly, I sort of had to learn it on my own, and we have no source textbooks to go for racing dogs. And I've applied most of what I know on the racing dog here in Alaska from experiences on the horse racing tracks in the lower 48. And I did work the greyhound tracks at one time. And there's very little information on racing greyhounds either in textbook or literature. There's just practically none. So I sort of had to learn it on my own and basically apply the fundamentals of the anatomy, the physiology, and your use of various pharmaceuticals to the racing dog to the best advantage.
What about, you also mentioned that you look at the dog and just listening to you discuss dogs, you treat them as like superior athletes that are like Olympic athletes. What about that? What kinds of things do you think about with the dogs? And I guess it's everything from diet all the way up to training.
You know, that's correct. Even diet has come a long ways within the last 2 or 3 years. And fundamentally, when I examine a dog, basically I look at the dog as far as his overall health. And he is an athlete and probably a very superb one, certainly far more superior to we as humans, in that not many of us can go 50 or 100 miles day after day, or for that matter, sprint 20 to 25 or 30 miles and maintain the performance over a 2 or 3 day race as the dog is. But he is a superb athlete, probably the best animal athlete we deal with at the time. Probably next would be the racehorse. The greyhound is certainly up there, but he's in a sprint category, much like a racing quarter horse or a thoroughbred. But the mushing dog is a distance animal and is absolutely superb athlete, and the dogs we come in that have earned training are absolutely in superb condition and health. They have to be to perform. You just couldn't perform with dogs that are either in ill health or not up to health standards or not up to training performance.
What about, like, the physiology of the sled dog? Now, there was two things that I recall hearing. One that surprised me as someone that didn't know much about dogs, that the sled dog's heart may be twice as big as a normal dog's heart, and also that the something about the fat on the dog is located inside the ribs or something like that. What about the difference in the physiology of the dogs?
That's correct. The sled dog, from doing a number of autopsies on sled dogs that have been brought into me, I've ascertained that the heart on the sled dog is about a third larger than that of the average pet dog. The same holds true for the racing thoroughbred. His heart is also about a third larger than the average horse. And I feel that with the racing dog or the dogs on the northern tier here, that they have a fundamental ability to store fat internally, even though they may appear thin outwardly. And I feel that this is probably an adaptation over the years to the cold northern climates. In other words, he does have a reservoir of energy or fat, which is internal. I see this also in the Malamute dog, too. And this was something that I had not seen or do not see in pet dogs or dogs from developed in the lower 48 or in European countries.
Let's talk a little bit about the things that you'll find in, let's just talk about Iditarod dogs. What kinds of things will you find in an Iditarod dogs, I guess, in terms of problems that you might not find in other types of dogs?
Well, probably the first and foremost problem that comes to mind will obviously be the foot problems, depending on the terrain and the snow condition. And their dogs, these dogs are forced to go over, or not forced, but have to go over terrain. They don't have groomed trails. The dogs are in and out of drifts where trails are drifted. So these dogs will be prone to various types of frostbite, not necessarily of the feet or the pads, but it'll be on the ventral aspect of the abdomen and down between the hind legs. Other problems that afflict the Iditarod dog and or distance dog, and particularly on a long race with a lot of dogs, is they seem to pick up various intestinal ailments, which with any large grouping of dogs would be expected. And certainly the sprint dogs get it, but usually they have contracted these things around town, and by the time they arrive at a race or a sprint situation, they're over them.
Let's compare Iditarod dogs to sprint dogs. What differences will a sprint dog have that maybe an Iditarod dog may not have?
Well, basically, they're both are essentially the same type of dog. There's a tendency now in our Iditarod dogs for the Iditarod racer to move on to a slower type of sprint dog, maybe a dog that's even a little larger, although some of them are down now in that 35, 40, 45-pound range that most of the sprint dogs seem to run in. However, they seem to prefer a dog that will trot for miles at perhaps a 10 or 12-mile gait, as opposed to a dog who will be loping a good distance of the race. The sprint dogs will lope pretty well throughout the race if it's any kind of a short race. They're fundamentally the same dog, though. It's just a slower type of dog, and he's gaited down slower than a sprint dog because he's got to pace himself out for the distance.
With that breeding, I guess it's just from my own experience of knowing mushers, they really breed for different types of traits in their dogs. Could you talk about the breeding for a while? Like what it seems as though it's been going on for years and years, people breeding in different things and breeding out certain things. A lot of people seem to think that if, for instance, the dogs out on the coast that are out there now, they wouldn't be out there if genetically the poor ones didn't make it and they're not there, like with bad feet, for instance.
That's right. It is a sort of, in a sense, a survival of the fittest, in that basically they try to breed for the dog who will maintain the desired performance. And they've introduced other lines of dogs. For instance, the Irish Setter has been introduced for its speed and stamina. The hound dogs have been introduced into the lines for stamina, the hound having a lot of stamina. They may be a little bit slow. They've tried other pet dogs. I've seen Airedale introduced into them. We've seen various hunting breeds, particularly the Labrador Retriever introduced. And I understand among some of the coastal dogs, where at one time they had reindeer herds, the Australian Shepherd was introduced to herd reindeer and ended up intermingling with the coastal sled dogs, which gives them their odd tricolor that they have now and then, or the black and white dogs we see, or what we call a blue merle type of dog, much like the domestic collie.
What about, along with the good points, there's always the bad points. You know, you start stressing a dog, and of course there's going to be some things cropping up. You mentioned before that there were some things that you've started to see in sled dogs that weren't there perhaps 10 or 15 years ago. What about that?
That's true. There's been quite a bit of interbreeding or line breeding or very close breeding. In other words, oftentimes a person has two desirable individuals they'll breed. Say a brother-sister mating, or perhaps a sire back to a daughter, or a mother back to its son, and this has introduced things like epilepsy in some of the dogs. We're starting to see things like one or both eyes being somewhat small in the dogs. We're starting to see some bone deformities, but usually these dogs are eliminated from the dog lot before they become too major, because those dogs just will not run. We're seeing primarily now a condition that afflicts most dog yards and many of the top dogs, and that's where they have very low thyroid activity. And this seems to carry on down through family lines. It may skip generations, one or two generations, or it may show up in every generation. And it's very definitely become a problem, very much as any of the pet dogs. In other words, we're seeing the same genetic problems that are seen in the show or pet dogs. The one exception being is that we do not see the poor hips or dysplastic hips that we see in so many purebred pet dogs. The sled dogs have superb hips and obviously have to have superb bone formation and conformation in order to run. They just can't do it without it. They're like a racehorse or any running athletic animal.
Frank, I'm going to run out of tape there. It's one of the best interviews I've ever done. What kind of, this might be a little repetitive, but what kinds of, could you go over some of the problems that an Iditarod musher is going to face with his dogs out on the trail? I know, for instance, like dehydration, foot problems and stuff like that. Could you just sort of go over those briefly?
Probably the first thing that the Iditarod musher is going to face when he leaves Anchorage or wherever his jumping off point is, fundamentally, probably most of the dogs are going to pick up some form of viral diarrhea, like an influenza, much in humans. And obviously, if this diarrhea is not brought into control, or if there's any vomiting associated with it, we're going to be faced with a problem of dehydration. Normally, the dogs don't have a problem with dehydration. Perhaps some if the weather conditions turn very warm, but basically no. The next problem they're going to have, and it's an obvious one, is going to be foot problems, particularly with poor trail or snow conditions, and maybe as in years past where they're going to have to run over open spaces of rock or sand, and it's going to be tough on the dog's feet, it's going to be tough on the sleds and the runners. And another problem that we do see in distance dogs because of the physiology of the dog is that we may see dogs show up with some exhaustion pneumonia, and this will be more pronounced if the weather turns warmer. The dog is an animal that must sweat through the lungs and oral cavity, unlike we humans or unlike horses who race. And so we do see fluid accumulate in the lungs on long runs with prolonged elevation in blood pressure, and particularly under warm conditions. And I do see this problem in sprint dogs on warm days. They salivate quite heavily, and they do have pulmonary problems with the heat. That's the only way the dog has got of cooling himself is through the lungs and via the oral cavity.
Okay. Okay. Now on to one question that I'm going to read this directly so we can make sure I don't phrase it incorrectly. But there's two different types of thought on the drug rule of the Iditarod. One school seems to think that no drugs at all are, you know, that's the way it should be. And then there's another school that seems to think that drugs such as like take aspirin or foot medicine would be actually better for the dog than nothing else. For instance, I guess the argument is that, you know, like if you've got a headache, it makes sense to take an aspirin rather than sitting there and ending up in, you know, with the headache. You can function better. What do you feel about drugs on the Iditarod?
Well, drugs kind of brings up in people's mind the connotation of either using drugs that are stimulants or depressants. I like to think of them as medications, much as you or I would take, for instance, if we have intestinal flu, we're going to take something to control the infection and control the diarrhea or vomiting. If we should get a blister on our foot or a sore on our toe inside of a boot or something, we're going to do something about that rather than let it go. I personally feel that a lot of the medications should be allowed. I don't approve of either stimulants or depressants and wouldn't advocate their use. I personally don't think they do that much good, particularly over a long span of time or a long run. But I definitely feel that there should be some sort of medication permitted so that the dog can maintain himself in reasonable health. The medications I would have in mind would be of a minor nature with respect to the overall health of the dog, and certainly if he became seriously ill or incapacitated, the musher would be dropping him off at a checkpoint anyway, and certainly the race veterinarians would ask that the dog be also dropped off. But he's going to be encountering things, the foot problems could be medicated while on the trail, the frostbite problems could be taken care of, the diarrheas could be taken care of, combating the dehydration associated with the diarrheas, and also some of the early pulmonary problems before they got severe could be very nicely taken care of, and I just see no reason why that can't be done. I'm not advocating stimulation or depression at all.
Excellent answer, and I can hear the tape going out. I was hoping that it wasn't going to run out before you were finished.
Something like that. Susie, the puppy that Donna wanted back and we purchased for $50, is still with us and is the dog that we'll probably be leading Ron into Nome this year.
Well, now when did Ron start getting involved in them? I mean, so this was the end of the first year, and you've got these puppies, and you've been out mushing and stuff.
Well, we decided, yes, we'd take these five dogs, knowing that we were moving to Clear, which was, to us, the middle of nowhere. And it kind of is. I was going to take them so that Ron would have something to do at Clear. I was ready to give them up and move on, try something different. Ron agreed to our taking the five pups, thinking, gee, this would give Judy something to do when we moved to Clear. Neither of us communicating that thought to each other, and now that's pretty much turned into to Ron's sport.
That is an interesting story, isn't it?
Do you still get out and run the dogs, Judy?
If we live most anywhere else. If we lived most anywhere else, or if the fellows would be gallant and take the team down to the bottom of the hill, I would, but it's really rather hairy and scary to go with fresh dogs down the steep hill. I enjoy it very much once we're at the bottom and head out, and I can handle little hills that way, but it's a little frightening going down the hill otherwise.
Anybody else have questions?
I've tried ski jouring with them, having them pull me on my cross-country skis, using a rope tow like for water skiing, that kind of a setup. And that's pretty fun. I enjoyed that. Did that quite a lot down at Clear, and a couple of times here with Duffy. He knows if I fall down and I say, he is, he'll go behind me and stop.
Are you going to cook all the meat or put the food together for the travelers?
I don't know that I have an option. Mama Grid's fudge is probably necessary ingredient in each of the checkpoint bags. Probably make some for Steve. Robert's a little apprehensive about what he'll be eating out on the trail. He would like steaks all the way. That's an easy recipe. Other than that, probably beef stew and chilies and things like that.
How do you prepare the foods, like in order to send?
Just make mass quantities and put it in seal meal bags, the boilable bags, and freeze them. Then when they're heating water, cooking for the dogs, they just put that right in with it and everything's, everybody can eat at once.
That's good.